Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Smina Rangano Girl. Okay, so excited. You guys are going to really, really enjoy today's podcast. I'm very happy. I'm still on this like ish-wish fall course high. We were, was one of the faculty, and I brought one of the faculty members to talk to her today. But I do want to give a trigger warning because a lot of what we're talking about is trauma, both sexual trauma and, you know, medical trauma. So if this is a topic that you're not ready to face at this juncture, or you know, you have not processed your own trauma and therefore this would trigger something, please, you know, do not press play. I would not be offended if you don't want to listen to this one today. But it does give a lot of pearls in case you ever want to dive into treating, you know, your own trauma, because I have the amazing Erica Kelly. Dr. Erica Kelly is a clinical psychologist at the Department of OBGYN, Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University of Hospitals in Cleveland. She's also an assistant professor of urology and psychiatry at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. She was one of my fellow co-faculty members for the Ishwish Fall course for the last few years. She's an associate editor of the Sexual Medicine Reviews and on the editorial boards for the Journals of Menopause, the Journals of the American Psychological Association Journal, Psychology of Violence. She was a 2024 recipient of the Editor of the Year Award for her service on that journal. She was a 2022-2023 chair of the Scientific Development Committee of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine Mental Health Professionals Group, MHPG, and is currently the chair of the Social Media Committee of MHPG. She was on the sexual dysfunction in LGBTQIA2+ community transgender surgery committee. She's been on the International Consultation of Sexual Medicine, ICSM. She's a member of the Educational Committee and the Scientific Committee, Program Committee. She's on my Program Committee because I am hosting the annual meeting. I'm putting together the annual meeting with the Scientific Program Committee. Her research focuses on perinatal mental trauma, reproductive trauma, female sexual dysfunction, and improving health access and outcomes in gender-expansive individuals. She is amazing. She's a wealth of information, and she's so hilarious. If you guys ever hear her lecture, I mean, just so much fun, so much knowledge, and really, amazing all around. So hopefully you guys will enjoy this, and let's get at it. Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Smina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Smina Rahman. Today, we have a very special guest. I just saw her last week. I don't know when this will air, but like we just completed our Ishwish Fall course, and one of my faculty colleagues and friends from Ishwish is here. It's Dr. Erica Kelly. Do you like my Oprah?
I do. I like this intro. I feel so special.
You get therapy. You get there. No.
I wish that's how it worked. I wish like it could
everybody
be.
Everybody gets therapy. Anyway, we were just commenting before that, you know, we feel like Ishwish is such a collegial sort of transdisciplinary like organization that really cuts across so many things that I think due to like some of us being heavily involved, we've changed a lot of the I think that we've changed. Don't want you agree? Like,
I think, and it's very, very empowering. Yeah. Like, I think I've never felt so like inspired and empowered.
Yeah,
and supported.
I'm still on a high. Like,
in my career, great.
I'm like, I'm just like, yes, this is amazing. We get to do this every day. Like, it's so awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of hope, which I think is good in healthcare.
Absolutely. Well, since we're talking about Ishwish and sex med, I always like to figure out, like, you know, we always like, you know, I'm gyno girl. I like a good origin story. So what's your origin story when it comes to, like, what brought you in? I mean, I kind of feel like most of us in this field, or probably in most fields, like, either come to it because, you know, we were very much, like, want to help some patients that we couldn't help at some point in our life. Or maybe we're entrenched in it and, like, maybe we're survivors of some, you know, disorder we're treating, whatever. But I think it's usually very personal kind of like journey, or maybe we felt sex shamed growing up. I don't know. What's your journey like?
Yeah. In fact, honestly, like I was just speaking about my experience and mentioning how like when I first started in this field, I did still feel that internalized shame. And I didn't tell people what I did. I was like very quiet about what I did unless they like worked in my space. And now I'm like so much more comfortable. But I feel lucky that I I got in early from the perspective of just like knowing what I was passionate about. And so my experience has always just been following my passion, which has been amazing. But I started freshman year of college. I entered a research lab that was focusing on dating violence and sexual assault and the impact. And so I looked at the impact on sexual health. So it was like sexual schemas. We looked at FSFI. Mm-hmm. So I was freshman year of college and like never looked back. But so, and I was a rape victim advocate at the time too. And so I was like seeing that real world impact. And a lot of it was around like the, you know, trying to give, I found research at first at that time was like giving a space for women to have a voice and like sharing their voice in a way that maybe they couldn't do individually. Yeah. So that's like really where I started with research. Yeah. And I majored in psychology and math and stats because I was so interested in research. So anyway, seeing like the being the rape victim advocate and going with women to their SANE nurse exams or, you know, there was, I remember depending on where the incident occurred and what hospital she was taken to, she may or may not have gotten care that I think most people would probably recommend. Yeah. Like maybe she could get Plan B and things like that. So that was very eye-opening. And then grad school just continued in the same topic area, different institution. And then I focused a lot on PTSD and trauma. So I would say like that was a lot of my grad school training. Mm-hmm. But again, very focused in intimate partner violence and sexual assault. And then my fellowship was a 2-year fellowship in women's health and aging. And there, I that's where I got probably the most like hands-on intensive experience in education in sexual medicine and menopause. I was introduced to cognitive behavior therapy for genitopelvic pain, penetration disorder, and then also vasomotor symptoms. Oh, so just kept going.
Well, there's two things that you said that made me want to think of something. One is that when you talk about shame around your profession, like to this day, I probably can't tell my dad, like when he tells me like, oh, I heard you're in the news talking about something. What was it? And I was like, oh, you know, just like menopause and stuff, you know, like cycle issues. Like I still can't say like, and he was like, oh, I heard you wrote a book. And, you know, somebody told me they saw it on your social media. And I was like, oh yeah, it's just about like women's health things happening, you know, like,
oh my gosh, Ryan, like you have so much to be proud of.
You know, it's not like he wouldn't be, like he'd frown on it, but it's just like weird for me to say in front of him kind of thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But the other thing that got me to think of something was, you know, when you're talking about all these traumas, and I'll definitely put a trigger warning in this episode.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when the Brett Kavanaugh hearings came out, you know, like back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I had the surge of patients coming in with genital pelvic pain issues, right? That I feel like it kind of triggered, like, and some of them said, I felt very triggered by listening to this testimony this week.
Yeah.
And so now I'm thinking about, I don't know if you recently saw the Instagram posts by, or the social media around the Jeff Epstein victims that were, you know, talking, the survivors. And so I'm wondering, like, do you see that a lot in your practice where, like, all of a sudden there'll be a surge of people talking about either the Me Too movement or survivorship and all this stuff, and then all of a sudden you get all these patients coming in or your current patients, like, you didn't get to the bottom of, but all of a sudden are unleashing because stuff has come up?
Yes. Yeah, I would say very much not uncommon for me to experience where someone was maybe initially referred to me for one specific concern, whether it be postpartum depression or specifically sexual dysfunction. Yeah. And, you know, it seems sort of surface level that we haven't seen any necessary, like very clear impact of trauma. But then through the course of working together, like the disclosures often come out. And I remember that was one of the earliest things that I had learned was the large majority, for example, of rape victims will not label it as rape. And part of that is like our social stigma and rape myth stereotypes and things like that, that make it really difficult for women to experience or to identify when they experience it themselves, even though you know there's the distress, right? But there's not always a safe place to disclose that. So I definitely see like surges depending, and it's very different now, I think, with social media than maybe it was 10, 15 years ago. I wouldn't have seen that as frequently. Yeah. Now with social media, I definitely see more of these like waves. Yeah. of disclosure and like women making connections potentially about, oh, I wonder, you know, this is coming up for me. I wonder if this is associated with.
I mean, the body keeps score, right? Like there's a whole book about it. Yes. So it's like, you know, I think that, can you talk to that a little bit about how we see it from, you know, the traumas and how, you know, our body, you know, represents some of those traumas in different ways or how we push it down a little bit and then it comes up all of a sudden. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like to think of trauma. Well, I don't like to think of trauma, but I'm trying to conceptualize trauma. And thinking about trauma exposure increases somebody's risk for post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. Not everyone will experience that, but many people will at least experience some of the symptoms.
Can you just define it for people that aren't sure what that means?
Yeah, sure. In my opinion, PTSD is a relatively unique condition because the symptoms themselves directly relate to the exposure to the traumatic event. So the onset or the exacerbation of them is directly tied. So as an example, you could have re-experiencing symptoms, which is like intrusive memories, thoughts, images of that event, or physically feeling like it's happening again. So this is the body keeps the score. It can feel physically like it's happening. And that's called interoceptive triggers or interoceptive experiences when you feel it physically happening in your body again, like it's happening here and now. So that would be an example of a re-experiencing symptom. They can have hyperarousal symptoms, which is, it's sort of like that fight, flight, freeze activation system on guard, you know, easily startled, jumpy, difficulty sleeping, feeling really disconnected from others, difficulty concentrating. And then I see this a lot, that there can be what they call negative alterations in cognition and mood. So like how you're thinking and how you feel, and it trauma tends to affect how you think about power and control, esteem, safety, trust, and intimacy when we're thinking about sexual health. So we know that those tend to be the cognitive areas that get affected. And then what happens is we as species are very much designed to focus on survival a lot of the times, right? And we're going to avoid threats, and we're going to avoid things that remind us of a threat, even if that's happening in our own body. So we have a tendency to avoid. But unfortunately, over time, with a lot of recurrent avoidance behavior, it can really just maintain the PTSD symptoms and maintain anything associated with that, like, you know, anxiety or substance use disorders. Yeah. So very, very fit. Like there's so many ways which it can get physically embedded in the body. Like it's your fight, flight, freeze response going kind of all the time.
You know, what's interesting is like back when I was a student and resident, we didn't learn a lot about sexual dysfunction. And I feel like, you know, obviously I can date myself and say this because it was, you know, 15 plus years ago, but also I think that the association was always like, oh, if you've been sexually abused or traumatized, you're going to have sexual dysfunction. And so that was the only association we were ever taught to make, which obviously we know is so much more to sexual pain and sexual dysfunction than that. But it obviously does manifest. And can you talk a little bit about how you go about treating it from, you know, a psychological point of view? Like, what are you doing for these patients that have these recurrent PTSD moments, or, you know, they're holding it in their pelvis and, you know, all the pelvic therapy in the world isn't helping because they haven't processed it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that that really speaks to the multidisciplinary approach that, like, I do so much in like collaborating with our pelvic floor PTs because they get the musculature, right? And that is the physical component, but we can talk about like the idiosyncratic elements of what are triggers in particular for this one person, because it might look different person to person. So in general, thankfully, there are evidence-based psychotherapies for management of PTSD. I personally trained in a couple of them. I do a lot of prolonged exposure therapy for PTSD. It's a very, I would say it's intensive. It's an intensive exposure-based. A lot of when somebody says, I want to process my trauma, I often think about prolonged exposure therapy because they're doing a deep dive.
But it's hard, right? You got to get them to like a 10 out of 10 before they can.
It's hard. It's really, really hard. I think, you know, I'm constantly feeling honored that women like trust me enough to walk that journey with me, because it is incredibly scary and hard. And, you know, we're doing that deep dive. And so prolonged exposure therapy is an evidence-based psychotherapy. Cognitive processing therapy, or CPT, is another one that I do. That one focuses more on like the thoughts that we were talking about, like power and control and safety. You focus more on how has trauma impacted how you think, and how can you retrain that mm-hmm. thinking to be more responsive to the real world around you and feel safer? Yeah. There's EMDR. I'm personally not trained in that. It was just sort of a matter of where I was at, you know, but I do refer a lot for EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. And then there's a couple of these other protocols that are, there's like an image rehearsal therapy that, or nightmare rescripting therapy, which I think is like really, really amazing, where you can essentially like rescript somebody's recurrent traumatic memory or traumatic nightmare. And it's evidence-based. So any number of those are available. Yeah. It does depend, I think, a lot on like, you know, the woman's goals and her, I'm very much patient-centered, as most of us probably are, but just thinking about like what their goal is, and depending, I would say on average, if there's PTSD comorbid with the sexual dysfunction, often treating the PTSD first. And that's pretty consistent with the International Consultation of Sexual Medicine recommendations that have come out on the psychological and interpersonal dimensions. So usually we'll do that. Sometimes it's like doses where like maybe we focus on one. I think I was recently talking about this with someone where we were focusing on like one experience of a sexual assault through trauma therapy, PTSD treatment. And then we got to the management of, I think, dyspareunia, the impact of dyspareunia. And then what was going on in the context of that was we were realizing a lot of the medical trauma was now coming up and getting triggered. So then we sort of went back and focused on that trauma. And then we're able to go back to focusing more on the sexual function. So sometimes it's like an ebb and flow.
And that's very interesting, because we know that when people think of trauma, they think of, you know, sexual trauma or, you know, physical trauma or, you know, trafficking, well, all these other types of trauma. But we know as a medical, you know, society and or, you know, in the field of healthcare, we can inadvertently traumatize patients. And this will bring us to some of the research that you did last year, right? Last year, you won the Erwin Goldstein Award for Best Abstract presented at ISHWISH. And so since we're talking about trauma, I wanted you to talk about that because it has to do with medical and obstetric trauma, from what I remember.
Yes. Yeah, I'm very, very passionate about childbirth-based PTSD and trauma, and see it, you know, happen quite frequently. And so the focus of that study in particular was a survey study, but we looked at PTSD symptoms in postpartum, and then we looked at something called the Sexual Function Questionnaire Medical Impact Scale, which is a really cool brief measure, and it basically women respond to the questions indicating how much did they notice that childbirth, their childbirth experience, negatively impact their sexual function. So it's specific, like they are specifically talking about what is that impact. And then they talk about their PTSD symptoms or lack of symptoms, in addition to whether or not they had traumatic childbirth. And so what we found was definitely that women who had experienced traumatic childbirth were more likely to have this negative impact of childbirth on their sexual functioning. And so we know that that's probably a high risk population then. And I'm a huge proponent of making sure that we are doing what we can to increase screening for PTSD and trauma in the obstetric setting, and going beyond that 6 week postpartum visit. Like a lot of the women in this study were, they were between, I think it was 12 weeks and 6 months postpartum on average. So that probably would not have been caught at a 6 week postpartum.
Right, because they're probably not even processing or realizing that they had, you know, they know they had trauma, but they didn't, they don't identify it like that at the junction.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, I can like talk about this all day, but this is my personal like coined term, but I call it the smiling PTSD. So postpartum depression is sometimes called the smiling depression because of all of the pressure placed on women for many reasons, including in postpartum, to be smiling. Like you're supposed to only be happy.
Should be so happy. Yeah, this is the baby. You brought life into this world. Like,
You can't possibly complain about your delivery experience. You should only be happy and only getting focused on your child. So it tends to minimize depression. And I see the same exact thing with postpartum PTSD. Yeah. It's that negative impact of like the societal expectations for women in childbirth and postpartum for it to be this like happy event. And also in what they call a helper context. Yeah. Like we talk about the medical system, that's a help, what we call from a trauma perspective, a helper context. You go in most of the time, maybe not, certainly not always, but expecting to be helped.
Yeah.
Right? Which is different than what we might think of as like a victim context, like an assailant, like a physical assault or something like that, where it's like a bit of a different social context.
Yeah.
But anyway, all of these sociocultural factors have, unfortunately, the negative impact on minimizing that experience for women. So they're much less likely to disclose and just put on their happy face.
Right, right.
Pretend like nothing's wrong. So I call it the smiling PTSD.
No, it's very true. And were you able to discern like race-based too? Because like not, there's also another thing that's trending right now on social media, which are a couple of bad obstetric issues that happened to Black women where they were pushed out of the hospital prematurely or not listened to and forced to give birth like in places that were not appropriate for them. And so, you know, there's a lot that is trending on social media right now about like Black women and maternal mortality. And so I'm wondering what you found about like women of color and, you know, other disenfranchised populations and how their trauma might present differently or, you know, what you saw with that.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that because actually we haven't analyzed the data yet. So there's a phenomenal, Dr. Rebecca Russell, who was a resident at our institution, had this idea and we built in a discrimination measure in that survey to also take a look at how is that impacting PTSD. We know a lot of things that are contributing to these healthcare disparities. One of the things is that in all reality, some of our screeners, like the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale and even the PCL, the PTSD symptom checklist, aren't necessarily validated for BIPOC women.
That's true.
Right. And that's if you're experiencing discrimination and you don't feel safe in healthcare, right, and you're worried about the welfare of your child, it is a normal experience, in my opinion, to be worried that someone is going to perceive that your child is at threat if you report that you're experiencing PTSD symptoms or depression.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of fear about even reporting that because, you know, you understandably would be worried about what's going to happen. Where is that going to get reported?
Yeah.
What are they going to do with that? So I think that's one of the elements is like our screening approaches as well. So not only do we see that obstetric trauma and discrimination, right, and racism and abuse happen, unfortunately, I think like the follow-up is also affected by things like that. ASLO has been working with Pregnant with Possibilities Resource Center, which is an organization in Cleveland run by Veranda Rogers, and they provide perinatal support and mental health services for Black women in the Cuyahoga County area.
Very nice.
Yeah, and we had gotten funding to do a study looking at basically what we're trying to do is improve our ability to recruit Black women in maternal mental health studies and maternal studies in general because we see barriers like similar to healthcare barriers. Same thing in research, like you've mentioned.
Yeah.
So we devised this basically like recruitment strategy that's more community based. Which is another thing I'm like just so passionate about is like we need to be embedded as I'm in academic medicine.
Yeah.
And we need to be embedded in the community. Again, like you don't feel safe in healthcare. Why would you come to the hospital to complete a survey for me?
Yeah, that's true. And how do you get over like sort of like the systemic distrust, you know, like the distrust that, you know, women of color, all the things that have because they know what. Even like when you think about, you know, how pain is looked at among, you know, women and women of color has been based on, you know, these misperceptions dates back all the way to like, you know, Marion Sims and all this, the work that he did on slaves and really learning so much of GYN on the backs of slaves. And so like when people understand this and they know this, like how do they get over their PTSD? They're maybe generational PTSD, right?
Like,
I don't even know like how the first steps would be how to engage the community in that respect. Cause then it's a twofold issue, right? One, we don't have enough research. We're not recruiting enough, but they're also not participating because of this generational distrust.
Yeah. I think a key element to focus on that I do believe will at least chip away at that is community-based participatory research. So making sure that we're working with the community from step one, like identification of what are patient-centered outcomes for research, identification of what is the research question. And so the project I was just talking about, like our way of approaching that was we were comparing flyer-based recruitment in a hospital, like what we typically do, versus posting flyers within the community setting and then actually going into the community, like coming to the community setting and presenting a recruitment presentation, basically. Me being a cis white woman, I need to get out of my clinic. Like that's unfair, I think, to be asking women from the community to come all the way, like to get embedded and work with the community. And it's building trust.
It's building trust.
And I feel like really, really honored that anyone would open the door to trusting me, because I think it's very understandable to have mistrust.
Absolutely. I think it's so interesting because, you know, I don't do obstetrics anymore. I haven't in like probably my last delivery was like 8 years ago or something. But I do say I think that it's an unfortunate thing where as a organization or as OBGYNs, you know, we're forced to make very quick decisions many times for the, because it is a life and death situation for two people, right? For the baby and the mom. And so I think my husband always says, like, I don't know how you ever did OB because it's so much pressure all the time, right? And it's a lot of stress for the team and this. And so they obviously need to do better, you know, in communicating. But sometimes it's like you have to walk, you have to go very quickly. You know, there's a C-section, the baby's heart rate's down. You have to move very quickly. And so the trauma that patient experiences isn't something that you can try to, you know, I don't know, mitigate immediately, because it's going to be something that, like, they're scared too at that time. Like, what's going to happen to my baby? And even I remember like hearing patients, they tell their OB stories about how they were, you know, they had someone jumping on top of them trying to get their baby out because of, you know, like shoulder dystocias and all these things are so traumatic. And so I don't know. I think, you know, having that advocate there is probably the biggest thing that we can do for patients, right? Because or like really, you know, understanding their risks ahead of time. But a lot of times it's one of these scenarios where we have patients. I remember being on labor and delivery where we were, you know, we cover all the people coming through and, you know, you have a patient that might be birthing at home with a midwife or by themselves or whatever. And then they come in. The most traumatic delivery I can remember was as a resident. And I was in charge of the unit and it was a woman who was at home with her midwife and had been pushing past a 9-centimeter cervix. So it was like totally wasn't fully dilated for a couple of hours. And she came in and her baby was like pretty much blue, like shoulder dystocia mid, you know, like, and it was, I still remember like how quickly we had to work and, you know, that baby, you know, still had, you know, developmental things happening to it, you know, during the time that we were there. And it was very traumatic. I mean, I'm still like, if I think about it, I would cry. So I think that, you know, there's some things that I wish we could do better with. And I always feel bad when patients tell me about their bad obstetric stories. Yeah. Because I know that the other side of it is too. I know what it's like to be that OB that is like trying to act so quickly that you're just so concerned about saving that mom or that baby that you're acting so quickly. So I think it's one of these things that a lot of it is not in our control, but whatever we can give the patient, whether or not it's an advocate or I mean, what do you think? Like,
I mean, spot on. I think like anything, I mean, literally anything that allows your patient to feel in control. I remember talking with someone about even they were going into an emergency C-section and they were trying to get their own shirt off. And they mentioned that specifically. It's like, that was the one thing I felt like I had control over. Mm. And I felt like kind of frustrated that came in and like wanted to take this out. Like, that's what they felt like they had control over.
Yeah.
So I think allowing control whenever possible, to your point, it's not always possible, but when you can, and nothing is too small, I think, like, do you want to lay this way or this way?
Yeah.
But when we look at the research on childbirth-related PTSD and what are the peritrauma risk factors, so the things that are like the risk factors happening at the time of the event, it's what you're saying. It's communication.
Mm-hmm.
It's lack of communication. And I cannot tell you how frequently I will see a woman with childbirth-related PTSD talk about the moment. Everybody rushes in the room. Nobody says what's going on. and she sees it on somebody's face, the panic or like the doubt or whatever, and reads that, but no one is explaining to her what's going on. Right?
Yeah.
That moment is so impactful, but I think it's never too late
to explain,
to come back and explain. I think that's something that, like, even if you can't do it in the moment, the fastest you can, the fastest you can come in and explain what happened medically, the better. Because that happens so much.
Because I also think the patient's going into shock too. Like, so, you know, even if you say the baby's heart rate is down and we have to do something emergently to make sure that baby survives, I do think there might be a shock element for some people that may have not been told. So I'm sure some people were not told. I'm sure 100% there was a lack of communication. Dissociation, right.
As soon as you can get in there, like, say something, the other piece is continuous support in labor and delivery. So if there is someone who can be there continuously and like help a little, you know, the shift change and all that, like if anything that can be done to allow for a little bit more of a seamless, like continuous, making sure someone is always in the room with her, I think is important, because so frequently, I'll talk to somebody, they say like, I just woke up, you know, after this emergency C-section, and I just hear somebody talking about blood transfusion and they leave the room and I'm alone and I have no idea what's going on. That's terrifying. They don't know where their baby is.
That's unfortunate. That's so unfortunate. But I can imagine that happening as someone that's been on those floors and been the resident or, you know, I know that we always try, I mean, especially as an attending, we've always tried to be like the center of commission. I think the other issue too is that the way the system is set up now, it used to be like, you know, back in the day, you'd have one OB doctor the whole pregnancy. And so you have a lot of trust in that doctor. And then you have one, and that doctor came in to deliver you. Like, that was just like the system in place. And now, of course, we have hospitalists that you'll never meet except for the time of delivery. Because I've been the hospitalist too, so I know how that feels. And it's also a fact of like, you know, you might be in a group that has 10 or 12 different partners and you meet a few of them, but you never, like my OB never delivered me, like any of my babies. You know, so it was like there was a huge group of 10 and I get, you know, well, you know, I don't, it didn't bother me as much, but still, like, I know that it really bothers a lot of patients. And so I wonder, like, when you have someone that's experienced all that PTSD in one pregnancy and then they're trying to potentially do a second pregnancy, like, what do you do for them? Like, how do you counsel them? How do you work with them? What do you suggest for them?
I think this is a cool piece of data too. I completed a pilot study looking at prolonged exposure therapy for childbirth related PTSD. So tailored the treatment a little bit to this patient population. So it's an existing treatment. It's just never been tested specifically for childbirth related PTSD. And again, we know there's some facets of that that's nuanced and unique. You've got the hormones, you've got postpartum that make it more unique. So we tailored it a little bit. One of the things I did was put together like a basically psychoeducation packet specifically on childbirth related PTSD and what childbirth trauma looks like and how it kind of manifests as part of this treatment. It was a small sample. I mean, we only had 6 women, but the outcome from baseline to I think it was 14-week follow-up, the mean scores on the PTSD symptom checklist went from clinical levels to subclinical levels. And we see the same thing for Edinburgh postpartum depression scale. Clinical levels of depression to clinical levels of depression across 14 weeks.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
It seems to be very effective. And that's what I tend to do, provided that it's what the patient wants to do. But I do love doing the PTSD-focused treatment. And then what we'll do often is basically come up with like a cope-ahead plan. What are, like, where we walk through, like, what are your expectations and hopes in a subsequent pregnancy? What do you think, what do we know the triggers will be? And then we start to think about, like, where do you have control? Let's think about all the places you have power and control and try to pick those out. Think about, like, what is it that you want and how do you think you can get the most support as possible at the time of labor and delivery? And then we think about, like, how do you maximize that communication? So whoever's with you, if you have a partner, you have a loved one, you have a doula, have it written down. That person has it too. And you can't over-communicate that.
Yeah.
Like every person that comes in the room, yeah, you go, this is what I want. This is what's important to me.
Yeah.
And really having whoever might, hopefully there's a support provider there. Sometimes there's not. But if there is, coaching that person and how can they best advocate for you? Because right, if you've been coaching.
And do you think a lot of labor and deliveries are trying to implement that? Again, I'm not on labor and delivery anymore. So.
Yeah. I mean, I feel very lucky to be embedded in an OB-GYN department. Yeah. And we're very collaborative. And so I do have, I think, a great opportunity to be like with the team, you know, and yeah, I will often get a referral for someone, for example, who's newly pregnant and they had a history of traumatic childbirth or loss. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about like, how can we best get you support? And I can help be a liaison mm-hmm. for that person with the other providers. Like that's a really nice, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
So I think anytime that there can be, again, like that interdisciplinary care.
Sure.
In fact, I had somebody this week that literally the referral uh-huh. was just, I just want someone to help me learn how to advocate for myself in this next delivery because I had a traumatic childbirth.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's really cool, actually, that like you can see what their goals are.
Yes.
Yeah.
At our institution, too, we are actually putting together now a voice of the patient mm-hmm. grand round, which I think that can be really impactful.
Yeah.
So we're bringing patient experiences of traumatic delivery and trying to best basically give that perspective to the healthcare providers directly to help bridge that gap and build more empathy and understanding of the patient experience.
Oh, that's great.
I think that helps.
That's really great, actually. They should do that. Like, I mean, if I had more pull at Northwestern, I'd say, come do it over here. Come to Grand Rounds. Wow, that's really great, though. I think that's something that I think that more people are probably becoming aware of, like, you know, the pains that women experience, the traumas that women experience. And again, it's not all just related to sexual traumas. And it's mm-hmm. although, you know, like these days you hear about all these, you know, bad things that happen to women from even at the hands of clinicians and doctors. Yeah. And it's really shocking.
Yeah. I mean, I think hopefully it means like there's increased awareness.
Coming forward. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think my experience has been too, like being on an interdisciplinary team. Uh-huh. I do think when I get referral for sexual dysfunction, my colleagues are very, very aware of trauma. Like they do a great job of screening for it and thinking about like how might that impact the woman's experience. And it's so nice to be part of that team because as you probably know, like even doing, let's say a pelvic exam or an exam for something like dyspareunia or vestibulodynia, and there's medical trauma or sexual assault trauma, like whatever that is, the pain,
yeah,
all of that can get in the way of being able to have an exam.
Yeah.
And rather than, you know, trying to force the exam to happen. Yeah. Like
you just give them an option. Like, and obviously, you know, a trauma-informed exam means you're going to tell that patient if at any time you're uncomfortable, we'll stop, we can have a chaperone. I usually mm-hmm. even bring in Pronox. You know, I'm like, do you want to use the Pronox, which is the nitrous oxide oxygen combination, to make sure that they're, you know, because a lot of times they're not having painful sex, but they have a lot of medical trauma, right? And so they're just like, I cannot do this exam. I had a patient who no pain with sex, but came in just because she's never had a successful PAP, but yeah. It's only because her first PAP was such a traumatic one at, you know, teenage years when she didn't have even gotten one or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And so as a result, she's never been screened. And so like, let's do this. Why don't you see if you can handle it with Pronox? I'm going to give you the speculum. Yeah. You're going to put it in yourself. You know, you just give all that control back.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, and she was like, that was the most enjoyable experience.
Oh my God.
So, you know, it was just so like next level for her. Okay, and so, you know, there's even that new speculum that came out a few years ago called the Nella Spec, which actually is, they have like a comfort kit that you can do for like patients that really get control. And it has like, you know, like a stress ball, and it has the speculum, like your own speculum. It has like socks that you can put on while you're, you know, like really comfy socks and, you know, whatever else. Mm-hmm. There's a lot in that thing. So people can bring that with them and say, I want to use this speculum. Because I think there probably are still people that are using sort of that outdated sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, like for the pelvic exams, if somebody does have significant anxiety going into it, whatever the trigger of the anxiety is, again, there's evidence-based psychotherapies for managing anxiety. So I will often do exposure therapy for someone who's having, you know, is getting ready for the, like, that's often a goal, is I want to have my pelvic exam within a year.
Yeah.
We can do exposure therapy to prepare for that. So they might be doing things like mimicking laying down, like their legs are in stirrups while at home. So it's like getting opportunities for essentially safe exposure of all of the stimuli that they would encounter at the time of the exam.
Yeah.
So that they can start to basically like recalibrate that anxious response.
Yeah.
So if you know a therapist or psychologist who has experience with, you know, anxiety, treatment of anxiety and trauma and sexual dysfunction, like these are strategies that can be done too. Again, depending on the patient and their history.
But, sure, sure. No, that's great, actually. And I think that, I guess, and that's pretty much the gold standard too, right, is exposure therapy when it comes to anxiety. Probably OCD too. Do you think OCD and PTSD are on the same spectrum of disorders?
According to the DSM-5, they are not. They're kind of in their, PTSD is its own, like trauma and stressor. OCD is within a different class, and then anxiety disorders.
They have overlapping.
Yeah, they do from the perspective of like these, the physiologic feeling of anxiety and intrusive or preoccupying thoughts that are anxiety provoking. Mm-hmm. But there's like very nuanced differences in them and nuanced differences in like how you might manage those thoughts. But across the board, each of them does have an exposure based cognitive behavior therapy approach.
That seems to be like the gold standard for how you approach them. What do you think about like mind, body, and like hypnosis? Do you think they have a role?
I don't have training specifically in like hypnosis, but actually I was just looking, this is sort of a different topic, but I was preparing something in the topic of menopause and was looking at the evidence-based strategies for management of menopause or perimenopause, and hypnosis is in there. As evidence-based. And so there is
like in the outside of the CBT category.
Yeah, right? Outside of the CBT category. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think I'm not an expert, so we can fact check this, but like it's got evidence-based for other things like smoking cessation. And I think, again, it's like very patient-centered care.
Right.
And some, like there's that deeply rooted somatic experience where I could see hypnosis being like really helpful.
Repeated for something.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about sort of rewiring or calming down that sort of autonomic response, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, whatever way that people can bring that about, like, you know, for some people, it is the 10 out of 10, get me to 10 out of 10 anxiety, and then I'll get, you know, which obviously is like even the physical aspects of vaginismus, which that involuntary contraction of the pelvic floor, you know, obviously has a root from psychological issues, but even the dilator therapy in and of itself, right? Like inserting a dilator is part of exposure therapy for that situation as well. So that's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, oh my
gosh. The creativity of like finding what's the right pacing for that person based on what their triggers are. Like even the difference of like insert the dilator with lights on versus lights off. Like these smaller ways to sort of scale between sizes of dilators is possible.
Oh, very good. Is that kind of some of the, when you talk about like with your vaginismus patients who have had some trauma related to either situations, is that kind of how you talk to them about even using dilators and stuff?
Yeah, a lot of the, I think, cool thing about, for example, prolonged exposure therapy, in addition to the trauma processing, they do in vivo exposure where they're doing gradual, safe, progressive exposure to the, basically, things that they avoid or trigger symptoms, and it can be very specific to the trauma. It can also be more kind of like the generalized, like a loud sound, car backfiring or something that triggers a response.
But
a lot of times with the in vivo exposure, we will build in, whether it be things like from sensate focus, sex therapy, or dilators, and we can build in any of the sexual function and sexuality stimuli into the in vivo exposure. And it dovetails beautifully.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's so awesome, actually. Well, I didn't even get to talk to you all about sensate focus and all these things. Maybe our next, but we just really dove right into trauma, which is amazing. I think like this is, I will definitely put a trigger warning, but like, this has been great. I think I love hearing your excitement over really helping these patients that have had such horrible experiences, either on purpose or inadvertently, or just because of the system didn't really prepare any person. Do you ever talk to the doctors that have been taught?
Yes, I do. No, I do.
Sometimes as an OB, I always, think highly about the patient, and I'm always really, and then I'll see the doctor that may have been involved, and, most of us are pretty empathic and go into this for reasons that are, empathy based, I feel like. And so you can, some people will leave medicine over such traumas and career, and so I feel like, there's so much trauma to be given out.
Yeah. I see a decent amount of healthcare providers for management of trauma. And this is also like just a totally different topic, but I'm very fascinated too. And there's something called the Vicarious Trauma Informed Institutions. And there's organizations that provide basically programming for institutions to be vicarious trauma informed because healthcare providers, for example, have high rate of exposure to trauma. And how is institution, right? Like supporting.
Because most of the time they either just leave OB or leave medicine or, and they hit some really depressive points in their lives too.
Exactly. Yeah. I think I've been there, certainly, it's hard. It is hard.
Yeah. It's hard. Anyway, this has been great, Erica. Okay, I have one question, though. I do this thing called the Vagilante Verdict because my husband jokes that, everyone that listens to my podcast are, Vagilante. So just what's your take home? What's your hot take? What's your, message, Vagilante Verdict for the people listening? Obviously, there's so much you can say because you're such a wealth of knowledge. But I guess since we focused on trauma, we can talk about trauma. What would you, the listeners that are medical providers or maybe they're, the patients, what would help them across the board?
This is something I say as a therapy mantra that I hold. I have two therapy mantras that I think is relevant in this space. Is one that my hope is that women that I see, women listening here, know that they can make decisions based on their value sets and what's important to them, and not solely out of depression or PTSD or trauma or fear or social pressure, that they can make values-based decisions. And that's always my goal in therapy, is often to help women on that path. But the other thing is to know that you can trust your gut judgment.
Yeah.
To know you can trust your gut and you can trust yourself, I think is incredibly important and empowering for women. When you experience all that mistrust and the medical gaslighting, you were right all along.
Yeah.
It's that you were not being heard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I love that. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Erica Kelly. You're just a wealth of information. I need to come. We'll do a part two, maybe after the new year or something.
Not forever. So I apologize.
Then when your book, hopefully it'll be a while probably, but hopefully you'll get the book out and it'll be amazing.
It's a goal.
And so you'll come on to your, book tours and I'll host you in Chicago. So it'll be awesome.
That'd be fun. Thank you so much. This was so great. I love talking with you. I love what you're doing. It's amazing.
Thank you so much. We had so much fun last week. Everyone should come to Ishwish. The annual meeting is in February. So
Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day. Thinking about sex.
Partners.
We're very medical about it though. Anyway. Okay. Well, thanks so much, Erica. Thanks everyone for listening. My name is Dr. Samina Rahman. Remember, I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. Please join me on my next episode. If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.